coming up on this, our final Star Stuff for 2014. The new Rosetta findings supporting claims Earth's oceans came from asteroids, not comets. NASA's Mars rover Curiosity confirms the red planet was once a warm world with regular wet seasons. And the unusual X-ray spike providing some tantalizing clues that mysterious dark matter could be linked to a hypothetical subatomic particle called a sterile neutrino. All that and more coming up on Star Stuff.
This is Star Stuff.
The European Space Agency's Rosetta spacecraft has found that water vapor emitted from comet 67P Sheremov-Gerasimenko is chemically different from most water found on Earth. The new findings, reported in the journal Science, supports earlier research which concluded that the hydrogen to deuterium ratios in water on Earth more closely resembles the ratios found in meteorites rather than comets. The discoveries provided fresh fuel for the ongoing debate about the origin of Earth's oceans. The new measurements were made in the first month following Rosetta's arrival at Comet 67P back on the 6th of August. And it's one of the most anticipated early results of the mission because the origin of Earth's water is still an open question. One of the leading hypotheses on Earth's formation indicates that it was so hot when it formed 4.6 billion years ago that any original water content would have boiled off. But today, two-thirds of the surface of the planet is covered in water, which begs the question, if the original water all boiled away, where did this water come from? In this scenario, it should have been delivered after our planet had cooled down, most likely from collisions with comets and asteroids. The relative contribution of each class of object to our planet's water supply is, however, still debated. The key to determining where Earth's water originated is the ratio of hydrogen to deuterium. Now, a normal hydrogen atom consists of a proton in the nucleus orbited by an electron. However, in the hydrogen isotope known as deuterium, the nucleus also has a neutron in addition to its proton. This hydrogen to deuterium ratio is an important indicator of the formation and early evolution of the solar system, with theoretical simulations showing that it should change with distance from the sun and with time in the first few million years. One key goal of astronomers is to compare the hydrogen to deuterium ratio in different kinds of objects with that measured for the Earth's oceans, in order to determine just how much of each type of object may have contributed to Earth's overall water supply. Comets in particular are unique tools for probing the early solar system. You see, they harbour material left over from the protoplanetary disk out of which the planets formed, and therefore they should reflect the primordial composition of their places of origin. But thanks to the dynamics of the early solar system, this is not a straightforward process. You see, some long-period comets from the distant Oort cloud are thought to have originally formed in the Uranus-Neptune region of the solar system. That's far enough away from the sun for water ice to survive. These comets were later scattered to the solar system's outer reaches as a result of gravitational interactions caused by planetary migrations involving the four gas giants, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. Now, conversely, Jupiter family comets such as Rosetta's Comet are thought to have formed further out in the Kuiper Belt beyond Neptune. Occasionally, these bodies are disrupted from this location and sent spiraling towards the inner solar system, where their orbits can become controlled by the gravitational influence of Jupiter. Indeed, Rosetta's comet now travels around the Sun between the orbits of Earth and Mars at its closest point to just beyond Jupiter at its furthest, with an orbital period of 6.5 years. Previous measurements of the deuterium-hydrogen ratio in several other comets have shown a wide range of values. In fact, of the 11 comets for which measurements have been made, it's only the Jupiter family comet 103P Hartley 2 which was found to have a match for the composition of Earth's oceans. Those observations were made by the European Space Agency's Herschel mission back in 2011. By contrast, meteorites, which originated in the main asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter, also match the composition of Earth's water. Thus, despite the fact that asteroids have a much lower overall water content, impacts by a large number of asteroids could still have resulted in Earth's oceans. And it's against this backdrop that the new Rosetta investigations are important. Interestingly, the deuterium to hydrogen ratio measured by the spectrometer aboard Rosetta is more than 3 times greater than for Earth's oceans and for its Jupiter family companion, Comet Hartley 2. Indeed, it's even higher than that measured for any Oort cloud comet as well. This surprising finding could indicate a diverse origin for Jupiter family comets. In other words, they may well have formed over a far wider range of distances in the young solar system than astronomers had previously thought. The findings clearly rule out the idea that Jupiter family comets contain solely Earth ocean-like water, and it adds weight to models placing more emphasis on asteroids as the main delivery mechanism for Earth's oceans. Now, speaking of water, NASA's Mars rover Curiosity has confirmed that the red planet's freeze-dried oceans were once home to a warm world with regular wet seasons capable of supporting life as we know it. The newly released images taken by Curiosity have identified an exposed rock outcrop comprising thick laminated, evenly stratified sandstone layers, which are commonly found on Earth where river deltas flow into lakes and seas. The suspended material in the water then settles onto the lake bed and gradually, over many years, builds up multiple layers of sedimentary deposits. These eventually cement together to form sandstone. NASA scientists say the new images from Curiosity are proof that the Gale Crater landing site was once a giant lake which experienced regular cycles of water-carrying plumes of flowing river sediments. This rock has since slowly eroded away over billions of years through the actions of sandblasting winds, leaving behind the cross-bedded sandstones imaged by Curiosity. The image was taken at the edge of a location called Hidden Valley, which is on the foothills of Gale Crater's 5-kilometer-high central peak, Mount Sharp. Curiosity has been exploring Gale Crater since landing there back in August 2012. The new findings suggest ancient Mars maintained a climate capable of producing long-lasting lakes at many locations across the red planet's surface. Now, if the hypothesis for Mount Sharp is correct, it challenges the notion that warm and wet conditions were a transient feature of local events on Mars. Instead, it supports the idea of a thick, warm and wet ancient Martian atmosphere, with global temperatures well above freezing point. Why this layered mountain sits in a crater has been a question which has challenged researchers for years. You see, Mount Sharp's lower flanks contain hundreds of exposed rock layers. That's the reason it was chosen as Curiosity's landing site in the first place. These rock layers alternate between lake, river, and wind deposits. Thus, they bear witness to repeated filling and evaporation of a Martian lake much larger and longer lasting than anything previously examined up close. Curiosity Project scientist John Grotzinger from the California Institute of Technology in Pasadena says there may once have been a series of lakes where Mount Sharp now stands. Curiosity is currently investigating the lowest sedimentary layers of Mount Sharp, a section of rock 150 meters high dubbed the Murray Formation. Rivers carried sand and silt into the lake, depositing sediments at the mouth of the river, forming deltas similar to those found at river mouths on Earth. And this cycle occurred over and over and over again. As Curiosity climbs higher up Mount Sharp, scientists will see patterns of how the atmosphere, the water, and the sediments all interacted. They may even be able to determine exactly how the chemistry in the lakes changed over time. After the crater filled with water to a height of at least a few hundred meters and all the sediments hardened into sandstone, the accumulated layers of sediment were then sculpted over time into a mountainous shape by wind erosion that carved away the material between the crater perimeter and what is now the edge of Mount Sharp. On the 8-kilometer journey from Curiosity's landing site to its present work site at the base of Mount Sharp, the rovers uncovered multiple clues about the changing shape of the crater floor during the era of lakes. Scientists found sedimentary rocks suggestive of small ancient river deltas stacked on top of one another. Despite earlier evidence from several Mars missions which pointed to wet environments on ancient Mars, modelling of the ancient climate has yet to identify the conditions that could have produced such long-lasting periods warm enough to maintain stable water on the surface. Astronomers studying the Andromeda Galaxy and the Perseus Galaxy Cluster have detected an unusual X-ray spike in their spectra, which they believe could be the long-sought-after signature for dark matter. Previously, dark matter, a mysterious substance which makes up over 75% of all the matter in the universe, could only be detected by its gravitational influence on normal matter. The new findings have been reported in the journal Physical Review Letters and on the pre-press physics blog archive.org. Scientists at Leiden University in the Netherlands detected the signatures in Perseus and Andromeda using the European Space Agency's Earth-orbiting XMM Newton X-ray telescope. The signal appears in the X-ray spectrum as a weak atypical photon emission, which could not be attributed to any other known form of matter. Above all, the signal's distribution within the galaxy corresponds exactly to what scientists were expecting with dark matter, that is, concentrated and intense at the center of objects and far more weaker and diffuse on the edges. Scientists then looked for and found the same signal towards the center of our own galaxy, the Milky Way. The signal itself seems to come from a very rare event in the universe, a photon emitted due to the destruction of a hypothetical particle, possibly a sterile neutrino. Now, if the discovery is confirmed, it'll open up new avenues for particle physics research and an entirely new era of astronomy. Confirmation of the discovery could also lead to the construction of a new type of telescope specially designed for studying signals from dark matter particles. It means astronomers won't just know where to look, but also what to look for in order to trace dark matter structures in space and eventually reconstruct how the universe formed. Well, sky watchers have had a busy weekend, with this year's Geminids meteor shower putting on quite a display as Earth passed through the debris field left behind by asteroid 3200 Phaethon. The Geminids, so-called because they appear to radiate out from the direction of the constellation Gemini, are the only annual shower produced by an asteroid rather than a comet. The 5.1-kilometer-wide asteroid is named after Phaethon, who was the son of the Greek god Helios. Phaethon's most remarkable distinction is that its 524-day orbit around the Sun takes it closer to our local star than any other named asteroid, just under 21 million kilometres, which is less than half of Mercury's orbit around the Sun. This close perihelion means Phaethon's surface temperature can reach more than 750 degrees Celsius. Now, that's hot enough to vaporise some rocks. And those rock vapors form dust trails behind the asteroid, which then become the meteors that burn up as shooting stars in Earth's atmosphere during the annual Geminids meteor shower. Now, all this has led to Phaethon often being referred to as a rock comet. Phaethon's strange comet-like orbit extends out beyond the orbit of Mars to about 359 million kilometers. And that's led to speculation that the asteroid may actually be a dead comet. Melbourne planetary astronomer Dr. Tanya Hill is speaking with the ABC's Rachel Brown.
So for most meteor showers, we plough through dust debris that's been left over from comet, whereas in this case, being an asteroid, the debris is actually a little bit more denser. And so the difference is that for a lot of these meteors, they're more long-lasting, and so you'll see a much longer flash through the night sky.
How close does Phaethon actually get to our sun?
It approaches about 20 million kilometres. To our sun. So that's well within the orbit of Mercury. And then what it does is that it goes about 400 million kilometres away from the sun. And it's this crazy continually heating up from the sun and then moving further away that actually causes the surface of the asteroid to fracture and leave all this debris behind that the Earth ploughed through.
And Dr. Hill, it's been a big year of space stories this year. We've had the European Space Agency's Rosetta probe landing on a comet, NASA's Orion test flight.
There's going to be a lot coming up next year. One of the big ones is that the NASA spacecraft, known as New Horizons, has actually just woken up and it's on its way to do a flyby of Pluto. Now, we've never seen Pluto up close. From about February, we should be getting some good views, and then in July is when the flyby itself is going to happen, and that will be just amazing. It's kind of the last of what we often thought of as the planets, what's now a dwarf planet, but it's the last one that we haven't seen exactly what it looks like, and so that's just going to be a big blast for next year.
The ABC's Rachel Brown speaking with Dr. Tanya Hill from the Melbourne Planetarium. India has rolled out its newest and largest ever rocket, the Mark III version of its GSLV, or Geostationary Launch Vehicle. The new heavy-lift rocket is slated to undertake its maiden flight on December 18 from the Satish Dhawan Space Centre near Sri Lanka. The new three-stage launch vehicle will provide India with a rival for the European Space Agency Ariane 5, America's Atlas 5 and Delta 4 Heavy, and the new Russian Angara rocket, which is also expected to undertake its maiden flight this month. The GSLV Mark III features a liquid-fueled core stage with two strap-on solid rocket boosters and a cryogenic upper stage. However, during this first test flight, the upper stage will not be included. Meanwhile, the Russian Federal Space Agency Roscosmos has confirmed that it's considering building its own space station. The announcement underlines just how strongly international tensions are affecting space cooperation following Russia's annexation of the Crimea and its ongoing clandestine military support for Ukrainian separatists. Roscosmos chief Oleg Ostropenko says such a space station could become a key part of Russian missions to the moon. Of course, it's not yet clear exactly how such a project could be financed, as Moscow is widely expected to enter recession next year and the economic crisis is aggravated by Western sanctions over Russian policies on the Ukraine. Washington wants to keep the $100 billion International Space Station flying till at least 2024. That's 4 years beyond the previous target. But Moscow's already rejected Washington's request to prolong the orbiting outpost's operations. The Russian space station Mir was launched by the Soviet Union in 1986 and kept operating until 2001. Russian President Vladimir Putin is now seeking to reform Russia's once pioneering space industry after years of budget cuts and a brain drain to the West, which has led to a series of embarrassing and costly failed rocket launches in recent years. Bit of good news for the Russians now, and a Proton M rocket has successfully blasted into orbit from the Baikonur Cosmodrome in the Central Asian Republic of Kazakhstan, carrying a new telecommunications satellite.
3, 2, 1.
Looks like we had a little bit of a delay here, but we have a liftoff. Liftoff of an ILS Proton rocket from the Baikonur Cosmodrome in Kazakhstan with the Yamal 401 satellite on board. 10 seconds after liftoff, the rocket does do a roll maneuver and will soon experience maximum dynamic pressure, which is also known as max-Q. And that's the maximum aerodynamic load on the vehicle. And for Proton, it corresponds to about Mach 1.6, 1 minute and 2 seconds after liftoff.
The Yamal 401 is being placed in a geostationary orbit from where it will provide communication services for Russian mining and energy giant Gazprom. The launch had been delayed for several weeks because of technical problems with the control system on the launch vehicle's BRISM upper stage. Meanwhile, an Atlas V rocket carrying a new generation spy satellite has successfully blasted into orbit from the Vandenberg Air Force Base in California.
Stable at step 3.
T-minus 30 seconds.
ECS reduced for launch.
Roger.
28.
Status check. Go Atlas.
Go Centaur.
Go L-35.
T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2. We have RD-180 ignition. And we have liftoff of the United Launch Alliance Atlas V rocket carrying the NRO L-35 mission for the National Reconnaissance Office.
Fuse gone to closer control. Mission program's complete.
You're hearing the voice of Marty Malinowski providing launch vehicle ascent data.
Performing well. And boosters throttled back. Roll program's complete.
The United Launch Alliance mission, listed only as NROL-35, carried a top-secret National Reconnaissance Office satellite into what, based on its launch trajectory, appears to be a Molniya orbit. Now, Molniya orbits are highly elliptical. They're designed to provide maximum loiter time over a specific part of the planet. This trajectory supports speculation that the clandestine payload is actually a new generation electronic signals intelligence gathering satellite known by the codename Trumpet. The mission also used a new version of the Centaur upper stage booster, equipped with the new RL-10C1 engine, previously only used on Delta IV equipped Centaur boosters. The flight was the final Atlas V launch of the year. And And an Ariane 5 rocket has blasted into orbit from the European Space Agency's Kourou spaceport in French Guiana, carrying two new telecommunications satellites into orbit.
À tous de DDO, attention pour le décompte final. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, top. Allumage Vulcain. Allumage des EAP. Tous les paramètres à bord sont normaux.
That rumble echoing across the Amazon jungle is the mighty Ariane 5 as it roars into the skies above Kourou. 54 seconds into flight, Ariane 5 has already broken the sound barrier. One incredible, powerful machine, 1,300 tons of thrust, breaking the Ariane 5 free from the bonds of Earth's gravity. 90% of that power right now, as this building just rocks, is coming from two boosters, each one of them 31 meters high, 100 feet tall. They're burning 240 tons of solid propellant in 2 minutes, more than 2 tons a second.
The launch of Ariane Space Flight VA-22-1 carried an all-up payload of 10,352 kilograms, including the two satellites and the dual payload carrier cradling them. 28 minutes after launch, the 6.3-ton DirecTV-14 satellite was deployed into its geostationary transfer orbit. It has a designed life of 15 years and will provide satellite TV services across the United States and Puerto Rico. 4.5 minutes later, following a series of controlled burns, the 3,181-kilogram Indian Space Research Organization's GSAT-16 satellite was released into its own orbit. It's carrying 12 years' worth of fuel and will provide communication services across the Indian subcontinent. The launch was the 77th Ariane 5 mission and the 6th launch for this year. And finally for this week and this year, moves to better track space junk, which could pose a threat to satellites and astronauts, has come a step closer to fruition with a recent announcement of a strategic Australian-American partnership between Queanbeyan-based company Electro-Optic Systems and US defence giant Lockheed Martin. The partnership is part of plans to develop a new space tracking station in Western Australia, which will search for and monitor orbital debris. Currently, the United States Air Force tracks more than 500,000 pieces of space debris the size of a marble or larger orbiting the Earth at over 28,000 kilometers per hour. Debris this small, but traveling that fast, can pose a serious threat to spacecraft and crews. As well as the little pieces, there are also more than 20,000 bits of debris estimated to be larger than a cricket or baseball. Most of this is made up of abandoned rocket segments, disused satellites, and astronauts' tools and equipment. There are even a pair of gloves up there which floated out of a Gemini capsule once. The big problems, however, happen when debris crashes into operational satellites. In 1996, a French satellite was hit and damaged by debris from a French rocket which had exploded a decade earlier. In February 2009, a defunct Russian satellite collided with and destroyed a functioning US Iridium commercial communications satellite, adding more than 2,000 new pieces of trackable debris to the inventory of space junk. However, the biggest problem was caused by the Chinese, who deliberately fired a missile and destroyed an old weather satellite just to show the rest of the world that they could. Beijing was widely condemned by world spacefaring nations for adding thousands of additional bits of debris to an ever-growing problem. NASA and the United States Air Force cooperate and share responsibilities for tracking orbital debris. The Space Surveillance Network tracks discrete objects as small as 5 centimeters in diameter in low Earth orbit and things as small as a meter in geostationary orbits. Currently, there are about 15,000 officially catalogued objects in orbit, but the total number of tracked objects exceeds 21,000. The new facility to be built in Western Australia will add to that space surveillance network. Electro-Optics Chief Engineer Dr. Ben Green is speaking with the ABC's Peter Ryan.
Ben Green, you're in the business of dealing with the massive problem of space junk, so how will partnering with a defence giant like Lockheed Martin help with that?
Our company spent about $80 million developing the technology to solve the problem, and now we face the next phase, which is deploying that technology in enough sites around the world to be able to track enough of the junk to make a difference in terms of forecasting where it will be to avoid collisions.
A key part of this deal is building a space tracking centre in Western Australia. How will that help improve the tracking of space debris?
Well, presently we only have one tracking centre, which is in the ACT at Mount Stromlo. And adding a station in Western Australia will give us another facility 3,000 kilometres away, which will not be covered by cloud when Canberra is covered by cloud. So we'll actually have a very high probability of having eyes on space all the time now.
Is there any particular reason why you need to have this new centre based in Western Australia?
Our first priority was to get it as far from Canberra as possible so we could escape the East Coast weather systems, so we'd have independent weather. And ultimately, we plan to deploy more sites. As long as they're more than about 1,500 kilometres from each other, I think it's a valid location.
One of the benefits that you mention in doing this deal with Lockheed Martin is that it will establish a global network of space sensors. Why hasn't that been possible before?
Well, the main reason it hasn't been possible before is that the technology was too expensive. Yes, the problem is very important, and it's worth a lot of money to solve the problem, but in the last 5 or 6 years, we've reduced the solution cost by about a factor of 4, which is a very significant cost saving. And now the cost of deploying and operating a significant amount of infrastructure is actually affordable compared to the actuarial calculation of risk.
We've been hearing a lot about space junk, and it was demonstrated quite clearly in the film Gravity. But is the problem of space debris accelerating at the moment?
Yes. And the problem is we don't know when the gravity situation, as shown in the movie, when that will happen. I mean, there are very serious analysis coming out of the US government saying that it could be within 5 years, but the mean expectation is it's about 15 years away. But it still means we have to move quite quickly. And even Lockheed Martin and EOS deploying will be bringing a solution to the market within 2 or 3 years. That's nip and tuck in terms of time if, in fact, the nearer predictions of the catastrophe scenario are correct.
Now, Gravity was the Hollywood version of the problems of space junk, but is it fair to say that managing space junk is a real problem for governments and businesses right around the world?
Absolutely. We've got $1 trillion, that's $1,000 billion invested in space assets, and we've got much more than that on the ground, dependent in the economy on those assets for communication, navigation, efficient movement of goods and services, bank transfers, finance, taking money from an ATM. Virtually everything depends one way or another on some element of that space technology chain. We've got essentially a race against time to deliver the solutions to protect those assets, because while we haven't been watching closely enough, the space debris problem has been escalating to the point where it's now taking out 2 or 3 satellites a year, which is not important in the overall scale of things, but if that turns into an avalanche, then we lose everything.
How difficult is it to negotiate this sort of deal with a defence giant like Lockheed Martin when you consider the security and defence matters and also secrets that governments hold pretty closely?
Well, the technology is always going to have some defence implications, if only because there are so many defence satellites in space that are under the same threat as the commercial satellites. And not all of those defence satellites publicise their position. So clearly, in this field, you're going to be moving into some sensitive areas automatically as soon as you start trying to protect assets in space, because it could be one of those defence satellites that triggers the avalanche. So we have to protect everything.
The ABC's Peter Ryan speaking with Electro-Optic Systems Chief Executive Dr. Ben Green. And that's the show for now, and in fact for 2014. But we will be back on January the 14th with the first show for 2015. If you're in the United States and you're listening to Star Stuff as a radio broadcast, don't forget you can also subscribe to the show as a weekly podcast through iTunes, or you can download it from the ABC Science website at abc.net.au/science/Star Stuff. Also, check out the Star Stuff blog, which contains all sorts of space and astronomy news which we can't fit in the show, as well as some spectacular cosmic images and other things I find amusing. The Star Stuff blog continues over the holidays, so it will be your best bet for finding out everything that's happening during the break. Just Google abcstarstuff.tumblr.com. That's all one word and in lowercase, and that's Tumblr without the E. There's also the official ABC Star Stuff Twitter feed, which has the latest Star Stuff broadcast times, radio stations, and publishing details. Just type in the @ symbol, followed by ABC Star Stuff, all one word in lowercase, and you'll never miss a thing.